Hello and welcome everyone to this week's edition of Sustainability Now with me, Justin Mogg, here on your community radio station. We are Forward Radio WFMP Louisville, broadcasting from the top of the historic Hayburn Building in downtown Louisville here at 4th and Broadway at 106.5 FM. And we live stream to the world. You can get us, man, anywhere you go on your summer vacation, although most people aren't even leaving the city, much less the state or country. But hey, anywhere you are, forwardradio.org, you can tune us in, live stream anytime. And that's also the place to go to get archived editions of our local programs like this one. And we're entirely reliant on you all to make this radio magic happen. This is all volunteer run. So if you want to become a volunteer with our station, go to forwardradio.org, click on participate. You can get behind the microphones or behind the scenes. And we also rely entirely on your financial contributions. And what a steal. This thing only costs $20 a day to keep going. That's a great community treasure. And you could support a whole day's broadcasting with just a $20 contribution at forwardradio.org. Well, my name is Justin Mogg, and what we do each week here on Sustainability Now is bring in folks from around the community who I think are already doing the good work of making sustainability a reality now, thinking about social, economic, and environmental concerns and how we can create that better future that includes all that good stuff at once. I mean, that is the challenge of sustainability, but it's also exciting, right? And I'm really excited to get in the studio with me now, Kurt Mason. Welcome, Kurt.
Yeah. Hi, Justin.
It's great to have you up here. Kurt is a legend in Louisville. He is a retired urban conservationist for Kentucky with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. It's a part of our U.S. Department of Agriculture. And he's also chair now of, because in retirement, what's that, right? He's chairing the oversight board for something that I think is a hidden gem in Louisville that more folks need to know about, and including me. I'm going to learn a lot today in our conversation. It's the Louisville and Jefferson County Environmental Trust. This is a land trust. Tell us, the listeners, a little bit about what land trusts are, because I'm sure a lot of them aren't even familiar with a land trust, and what the mission of this one is.
Okay, so land trusts are generally organizations that are formed to help preserve open space, farmlands, wildlife habitats, areas with critical habitat for different species, and also for wetlands and a lot of land use that might otherwise transform in the future to some other use other than what it's used for now. So it's a way for people that own or manage those properties to protect those in perpetuity by putting restrictions on the land that designates its future use.
Okay, now, instantly what pops into my mind as a question is, so is this private land or public land?
It could be both. So a lot of land trusts, for instance, deal with private landowners that own land, and it may have some historical significance to their family. Maybe it's been the family farm that's been in the family for generations, and they would like to see that preserved as a work in agricultural piece of property.
Okay.
And also to preserve that family history. And so the owners of the property might put what's called a deed restriction or conservation easement on the property that says what it can be used for in the future. So that's on the private side. And there's also land that's public land that's in land trust, that's in a conservation easement. Because politically, a lot of times when you change the head of a government, sometimes they see the need to have open space or these areas designated for the public, and their will and their intention is good. But then when the administration changes 10, 12, 20 years down the road, somebody else has another vision and they decide, well, we don't need to hold on to this property. Let's sell it for development. So there can be conservation easements put on public land that ensures that it is used for a designated purpose in perpetuity.
Yeah, okay. And when we start talking about this term development, we get into tricky territory because certain types of developments might even be allowed within a land trust, right?
Sure, yeah.
But not the traditional mow everything down
right, and
put up a shopping mall, right?
And a lot of times when you start thinking about putting a conservation easement on the piece of property on a land, your key word there is conservation. I mean, it has especially if someone decides to put a conservation easement on, let's say, on a tract of farmland, and they want to prevent that from being developed at any time. So essentially what they're doing is taking away the development rights on that property. Those are no longer in place. They've essentially given those land rights to some other agency, group, or organization that might have a conservation purpose. And when those development rights are taken away, it becomes deed restricted. So that document is actually filed in the local courthouse. It has a deed book and page number. And in perpetuity, forever, that document states what can and can't be done to that property, kind of in a general sense.
Like sometimes you can use it as a working farm. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily say you can put a barn here or.
Yeah. Usually conservation easements are written with the landowner that wants to put those on. And it's written with their thoughts in mind and also with some type of conservation vision in mind.
Right.
So if it's for agricultural purposes, generally you can put structures on there that augment the agricultural operation. It could be barns, it could be sheds, it could be running sheds for horses, but it has to tie in with the agricultural part. What it might do is, for instance, it may limit the number of private residences that can be placed on that property. So, for instance, if you had a piece of property that was 300 acres in size and someone decided they wanted to put a conservation easement on it, they kind of negotiate with the easement holder as to how many houses might go on there. Maybe there's a house for the owner of the property, and if they've got three kids, maybe they want to reserve three home sites for the kids.
That's
reasonable. And then the rest of whatever might be called the potential home sites or developments are actually taken off the table. So those documents are written kind of with an eye on the future, what the intended use is, what the conservation intent is of the property, whether it might be scenic beauty, it could be a wildlife habitat, it could be water quality, it could be production agriculture, and the owner of the property kind of gives that vision, and the land trust usually works with them to see how that matches up.
Could an objective be, has anyone done this, an objective being carbon sequestration?
It could be. Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, because that might be a new model in these times of trying to mitigate climate change.
So there's a number of different land trusts out there, and a lot of the land trusts have different missions.
Yeah.
For instance, the Nature Conservancy, which is a land trust, their real interest is preservation of habitat and critical areas for species. And so that's kind of their target. Then you may have another land trust whose emphasis is strictly with woodland areas.
Right.
And then there's, in Kentucky, there's a governmental land trust called PACE. It's a purchase of agricultural conservation easements. And their mission is really to preserve working agricultural farms. Their interest is not critical habitat. Their interest is not wildlife habitat. It's the productivity of land for future agricultural use. So when I talk to people about conservation easements, I tell them it's like going into a marriage. You find the right partner to fit with you. So you look around and you try to find out what other land trusts might exist that have your same missions in mind. And if they have those same missions and the same outlook, then you fit well together. And if not, then maybe you try to look someplace else for an organization that might be able to hold a conservation easement.
So what then would be the mission and these types of conservation easements that are incorporated into the Louisville and Jefferson County Environmental Trust?
Okay, so the Louisville Jefferson County Environmental Trust was actually formed in 1997.
Pre-merger,
Pre-merger.
Yeah, wow.
And at the time that it was formed, there was some interest with folks that wanted to put conservation easements on land, but they couldn't find that right marriage.
Okay.
They couldn't find that right partner. So in Kentucky, believe it or not, there's not a great deal of land trust organizations. As a matter of fact, there's not very many at all in the western part of the state.
Wow.
You would think there would be more, but there's not. Huh. And in 1997, there were not a lot of land trusts in the Louisville-Jefferson County area that really looked at holding conservation easements on smaller parcels of land, on green spaces that might have been held, for instance, just for its woodland canopy.
Mm.
And there was a land trust here. It was called Riverfields, which is still in existence. And at the time, Riverfields really had a mission area along the Ohio River and up Harrods Creek. They didn't really do a lot with southwest Jefferson County, eastern Jefferson County. If it wasn't within their corridor, they really had no interest of holding easements there. You had places like the Kentucky Nature Conservancy. Unless you happen to have critical habitat for rare and endangered species, they weren't really interested in holding a conservation easement. And so the Louisville-Jefferson County Environmental Trust was really formed to fill in a gap, a missing piece of where land trust interests were, but also to kind of look at that time, it was Cornerstone 2020 that had written into it the preservation of open space and farmland within Jefferson County. And although it was written in Cornerstone 2020, there may not have been a vehicle that really had the capability of holding those conservation easements. And so the Louisville-Jefferson County Environmental Trust was formed, and it's a unique land trust, kind of for Kentucky, because it's called a quasi-governmental land trust, meaning that it was established by Jefferson County government, and it is run by a board, and that board is comprised of 9 members. And by ordinance, there are 4 agencies that have a footprint on that board. That's the head of Metropolitan Sewer District, the head of Planning and Design Services, the head of Public Works, and the head of Metro Parks. So those 4, just because they have an interest in some type of land management in Louisville, Jefferson County, or in Jefferson County at that time, they had a big footprint on land in Jefferson County.
Yeah.
And then there were 5 citizens that were on that board. And it was intentional to have 5 citizens, one more than the representative of government.
Wow.
So if there was ever a vote that the citizens' interest really rose to the top instead of being metro agencies.
Okay. So since 1997 then, roughly how much land has been incorporated into this trust?
Okay, so the Environmental Trust currently has 16 conservation easements, and there's roughly approaching 2,000 acres.
Wow,
now,
okay.
Granted that some of those easements are small, the largest easement that we hold is a little bit over 800 acres, 850 acres, and the smallest one is about 12 acres in size. And again, we look at the uniqueness of the land. We also, of interest to Louisville and Jefferson County, is we hold some easements outside of Louisville-Jefferson County.
Oh.
We hold some easements in Oldham County, which feeds part of the watersheds that come into Jefferson County.
Yeah. So it's all connected.
Yeah, it's connected. And for years, I have really preached to folks, it really makes a difference what happens upstream. Okay, so there should be a little bit of interest of Jefferson County of what happens in Oldham and Henry and Trimble, just like the people in Bullitt County should really be concerned what we pass down to them.
Sure.
So it's connected.
Yeah.
So it's in the interest of Louisville and Jefferson Countyans not only to look at preservation of open space and farmland, not only in Jefferson County, but upstream in watersheds, because if they build out, we get the brunt of what happens.
My guest today here on Sustainability Now is Kurt Mason, retired urban conservationist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and you know, still working in retirement. He's now on the chair of the oversight board for the Louisville and Jefferson County Environmental Trust. Indeed, it's quasi-governmental, so you can learn more about it on the city's website, louisvilleky.gov. But there's also a Facebook page for the trust. It's on Facebook at Louisville Land Trust. Already 2,000 acres. Do you get inquiries all the time, or is this really a hidden gem that most people don't know about?
We get inquiries, but a lot of people don't know. And just in the general concept of owning land, a lot of people aren't familiar with conservation easements. And the one thing that people that have farmland and open space that they might have some type of interest in preserving in perpetuity is that they never really want to sit down at the table and have a discussion about what's going to happen with this property when I die.
Yeah.
It's like, and I've talked to landowners and they said, well, I'd like to keep this in the family for years, but I just don't want to have that conversation with my kids. They'll figure it out when I'm gone. And that's not a good way to leave your family, is to make plans with it. And so I grew up on a farm in central Kentucky. We still have the family farm. It's been in our family for about 75 years.
Nice.
And so I just remember growing up, there were two siblings, my brother and I. We were a year apart. We grew up fighting all the time, just like brothers do. And if there was one candy bar, my mom would break it in two and say, here's your half, here's your half. And then we'd fight about whose half is bigger. Okay. So, and I said, well, your kids are going to have that same problem. I mean, they leave the landscape, they leave the farm. Maybe one of them really likes the farm, the other one doesn't. Maybe there's some ways to share assets, but certainly if it's something that is really desirable for your family to keep in their family for years, then maybe do something to protect that. And in some cases, which is really kind of interesting here in Louisville, Jefferson County, and also some other urban spaces, is that even with a conservation easement on the property, the value of that property may not change all that significantly because we don't have real big farms here in Jefferson County.
Right, right.
So there may always be somebody that's looking for 40 acres, 25 acres that they'd like to call their own. And those 25, 40 acre blocks of land still have a pretty high value in terms of what they can be used for in the future. And so if there's critical water quality areas or habitats or old buildings or something on it that you'd like to preserve, take a look at it. Depending on what your income level is, there may be some tax advantages for putting a conservation easement on a piece of property. So right now, with the current tax structure, usually with a conservation easement, if you're interested in taking the tax advantage of it, you get an appraisal on the property. Actually get two appraisals on it.
Okay.
And one of the appraisal is what is the current value of that property for whatever it's used for. If it's agricultural purposes, what's its ag value? So it has an appraisal of a current use, and then there's what's called, I've never really liked this term, it's called the highest and best use.
Right.
To me,
right.
I think 40 acres of trees is the highest, that's best pretty, use and calling that you can have for a property. But it's really based off of
economics
and real estate value.
So
if that land were developed into houses or some type of commercial or industry area, what would its value be? So you take the current value, and then you look at its highest and best use value, and the difference between those two values becomes what's called the conservation gift. You're giving away the right to future develop that property into a scheme of subdivisions or whatever. So that becomes the gift. It's just like you donating a car to Goodwill. Okay, so you've donated something to the public. And what the public doesn't realize that they're getting is they're getting preservation of air quality. They're probably getting some water quality attributes. They may be getting wildlife habitat attributes. They could be getting scenic value. And those things are public assets. Okay, the public benefits from that. And so for some folk, it's worth looking at conservation easements if they've got in mind, I'd like to preserve this property, but I'm also in a situation where I could use a tax benefit and strip away the development rights and find somebody to marry with, an organization that has your interest in mind and their responsibility as a easement holder. Their biggest responsibility is to take that document that you have prepared with them and ensure that those things are carried out, even if you decide to change your mind.
Okay.
Even if you decide to change your mind, you have to abide by what's there.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was in a meeting, and this was a meeting that dealt with development of some areas in the eastern part of Jefferson County. And there was a developer that asked the question, well, what gives somebody the right to put a conservation easement on a piece of property and take away the development rights on it? And so my response was the same right that you've got when you buy a piece of property and decide to put 100 houses on it.
Yeah.
You've changed that forever. And on the other hand, the other side of the fence is they preserve that in perpetuity forever. And as a matter of fact, if you have a subdivision right next to a preserved piece of property, the value of your property in that subdivision actually automatically went up. So when you think about a lot of the battles that happen on the landscape where a subdivision might be coming in, is after a subdivision is there and the next parcel next to it is going to be developed, it's just everybody in that subdivision just kind of had some ownership to that open space next door, and they don't want to see it change.
Sure.
Well, if you put your house right next to a piece of property that's going to be in farmland or open space or trees in perpetuity, then you know what your backyard's going to look like.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to fight a high-rise coming in your back door.
So do neighbors advocate or somehow put in letters of support or something like that for these kinds of deed restrictions?
Not really, but they value those.
Yeah, they sure do.
I've talked to people that lived in subdivisions that's right next to preserved piece of properties, and they just go on about how glad they are that it's going to stay a wooded area. They like seeing deer in the back part, or they like seeing the cattle or the native grasses. And they know when that property transfers to another owner, they essentially kind of know what that owner's limited to do.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I want to get to an understanding of, like, who's policing all this? And you mentioned the term earlier, landowners needed a vehicle to put their land into trust. Could a landowner just put a deed restriction on their property without a land trust? But either way, who's policing all of this development?
Okay, so good question. The responsibility of the land trust, again, their biggest responsibility is to monitor the easements, is to ensure that whatever's written is done.
Okay.
And so they're the policing agency.
Yeah, okay.
And whether it's a private land trust or whether it's a governmental land trust, their biggest responsibility is to monitor and enforce. A person can put deed restrictions on a piece of property, but there's nobody that monitors that. It's like you can't monitor your own easement because you can't slap yourself on the hand when you do something bad,
okay,
or out of place. So with the Louisville Jefferson County Environmental Trust, we monitor every one of our easements at least once a year.
Oh, okay.
And actually, in actuality, it's more than that, but we have a monitoring schedule that we meet with the landowners and on the property, and we do that on a schedule of, on a four-year schedule, we will do a spring monitoring, a winter monitoring,
oh, really?
A fall monitoring, and a summer monitoring, because we get the benefit of looking at what different types of vegetation, wildflowers, and other things are there during the different seasons.
Sure.
If there's something that's going on next door to a conservation easement, we'll monitor that to make sure that something doesn't step across the fence and encroach into the easement. And usually, if the property sells, if it ever changes ownership, we will meet with the new owners of the property to ensure that they know what that conservation easement is. In a lot of cases, we would even like to talk to people before they buy that property.
Yeah, you don't want to surprise them with that.
Because, I mean, the realtor should disclose that there's a conservation easement, but a lot of times realtors don't know.
Really?
It's kind of like that 100-year floodplain, and a lot of realtors will say, well, that doesn't ever flood.
Yeah.
They said it floods once every 100 years. Well, that's not what a 100-year floodplain is. It's not that it floods once every 100 years. It's a frequency storm event. So it's kind of misleading. So with people that are getting ready to buy land that's a conservation easement, it would be critical for them to look at what can and can't be done. We had one piece of property that I remembered that changed hands only for a short period of time. A guy owned it for probably less than 6 months, bought the property and thought that they were going to be able to develop that into single family housing, and didn't know about the conservation easement on the property. The realtor didn't tell them, and they didn't do the research good.
Wow.
And when they found out that they couldn't do single family housing on it, and they sold it. And they sold it to somebody that said, I really like the place. It's got this place right at the high point on the property where there's a house. It's wooded around the outside, and it's got walnut trees all over it. It's exactly what we were looking for. Mm. And so it worked out.
Yeah, okay. So all that work of sort of administrating and policing it, that's not free. That takes some money. Is this where the quasi-governmental piece comes in?
That's where the quasi-governmental piece comes in.
Yeah.
So the difference between a quasi-governmental land trust and a private land trust is a private land trust has to be accountable for raising all of their funds to do everything that they need.
They need an endowment or something.
Right. They need an endowment. They need fundraising. They have a paid staff.
Yeah.
They have vehicles. Anything that runs a business, they've got to pay for. So the public does pay for the Louisville Jefferson County Environmental Trust because we use staff from MSD.
Okay,
and
good. Okay.
When you think about MSD, they have all kinds of folks there. They have engineers. They have water quality folks. We've got the whole gamut of MSD to reach out to. We have the same thing with parks. So parks has natural areas folks, and they have landscape folk. So they have a myriad of staff that we can pull from. Planning and design services, the same thing, and also with public works. So we don't, as the organization by itself, the Louisville Jefferson County Environmental Trust has a director right now that's actually housed with the Public Works Department.
Okay,
she's kind of our administrator person. And we have I call it a working board. We have a working board. Those five citizens do a great deal of the monitoring along with some of the staff from Metro government. And that working board actually does a lot of the day-to-day stuff that needs to be done with the Environmental Trust. And then we can call on all of Metro government if we need to produce maps or if we need to find deeds. We have our own attorney through the county attorney's office. All of those things, when you look at a private land trust, they have to have that on their staff or raise money for it.
Yeah, okay. I'm getting a good understanding now of how this whole thing works. My guest today here on Sustainability Now is Kurt Mason, chair of the Oversight Board for the Louisville and Jefferson County Environmental Trust. Again, you can learn more about it on the city's website, louisvilleky.gov, and they have a Facebook page, facebook.com/Louisville Land Trust. I want to move on a little bit to talk about broader urban conservation issues, because you had this great career as an urban conservationist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. How would you define urban conservation versus, say, rural?
I'd been trying to explain that to the agency that I worked with for years. Really, when you look at urban versus rural in terms of conservation and land use, it's smaller scale.
Okay.
And it's more connected to higher populations. In a lot of cases, you have maybe the secondary use of land. It had something on it before it became part of the urban conservation or urban agricultural landscape. And with the rural side, you think more of larger traditional animal agriculture, larger acreages, and its connectivity to the urban space is trying to bring things in, whether it's fruits and vegetables, or in the case of here in Louisville, Jefferson County, we have grain terminals that farmers from outside of the area bring things into the city so that it can be shipped out. And so the urban is usually smaller in size. And the other thing that I've seen with urban farming is that it's young people. It's a lot of young people.
Okay, yeah. Whereas our farming population in general is aging quite a bit. Yeah,
it's aging, and a lot of their families aren't going back to the farm in the rural landscape. But then you see on the urban side, you have new generations coming in to farm smaller pieces of property. The rural landscape is more mechanically driven, with larger equipment, bigger investments, and they think more in terms of probably more single types of produce, whether it's cattle,
okay,
or whether it's hay, or whether it's some other staple that's grown.
Yeah. But whether it's urban or rural conservation, the fundamental effort is to try and preserve ecological function, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And the, ecological function happens at all scales, like it happens at the molecular scale even, right?
Yeah.
But we're also thinking about potential productive uses even in that context of ecological conservation, right?
Right. Yeah. And so it kind of brings me back to when I was growing up. Like I said, I grew up on a farm in Scott County. And we were a traditional farming operation at that time. We raised tobacco and beef cattle, a little bit of corn, and a bigger garden than I ever wanted
to think of.
Yeah, yeah. And so we were more traditional in nature of what agriculture was. But we also used these conservation tools on our property. And when I talked to young people, I said, well, when I was growing up, we used to keep our livestock in buildings in the winter. We used to winter feed them, and there would be manure all over the place and old hay. And one of my jobs, along with my brother in the fall, was to get in those barns and those sheds and shovel out all the manure, put it in a manure wagon, put it back on the field for organic material. Kind of similarly what's done on the urban landscape with composting.
Exactly.
I mean, exactly the same thing. And so we used a lot of organic material on our farm without even calling it organic.
Right.
It was like, oh, no, spring's here. We've got a pitchfork out where the cows have stayed all winter and put that stuff where we're going to grow tobacco or where we're going to grow corn or something at. And so that return of the organic material back to the landscape is one of the things that's missing on a lot of traditional rural landscape farms. But you see it heavily used in the city.
Okay.
In terms of composting. They don't do a lot of manures because sometimes your neighbor doesn't want to smell the manure.
Yeah, there's more odor. Yeah.
But they do heavy composting. They also use, on a broader scale, a lot more cover crops in a lot of cases than they do on the traditional rural landscapes.
Huh.
But cover crops are coming back because it's finally hitting people, especially on the rural landscape, is that you can make money on the farm by taking care of your soil and improving the biological diversity, okay? So improving that biological diversity means that when you harvest a crop, you need to put something else green growing out there for root systems. And I just got off of a Zoom call with some kids with YPASS with the food literacy group. And I was talking to them about there's actually more livestock underneath the ground than there are above the ground. And it's the microbes and everything that's in the soil.
That's right.
And one of the things that we had forgotten to do years and years ago is we stopped feeding the livestock underneath the ground.
Yeah.
And that's where they have to have those conservation covers on top of the ground with live roots, with root mass, and with top growth so that those things can continue to eat and work for you when spring gets here.
You say you can make money by cover cropping, but you can also save money, right?
Yes.
The traditional way conventional farmers are making up for this loss of fertility is by purchasing chemical fertilizers,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
And so a farmer who does this right could be saving money on both sides of the balance
yeah.
sheet.
So one of the best and worst things that happened to traditional agriculture was the advent of commercial fertilizer.
Yeah.
When commercial fertilizers came out and you bought the stuff in the bag, you neglected the natural fertility in the soil. You thought, well, if the fertility goes down, I'll go to southern states, buy some bags of fertilizer, put it out there. And essentially what you did was you hooked your plants on drugs.
That's a good way to think of it. You hooked them on
that fertilizer. No longer was the microbes and things working for you and improving the fertility and the porosity and all those things in the soil. It's let's go to southern states and buy 15 tons of fertilizer and make stuff green and have it to grow. And now it's kind of a return that says maybe we should rethink that. Maybe we're not doing what we really need to do for our soil, for our water quality, and for the soil health by just force feeding stuff into the soil to force it to grow. And so I was glad to see that come back. And maybe I would like to see some younger kids fork out manure out of a barn every now and then. And,
that's good for you.
And you start to think about, yeah, that stuff really has, it has value to it.
Yeah, yeah. And value to the whole landscape, to everyone, because if we have to go this chemical route, and also tied into the chemical fertilizers are all these chemical pesticides, right? Because right. you basically have an unhealthy, undiverse system that you have to prop up with all these other chemicals.
Yeah.
That stuff doesn't just stay on the farm. It moves.
It moves. It moves.
And let's talk about, I mean, we're nearing the end of our time, but I especially want to talk about the context here in Louisville. And it ties back to where we started out talking about the land trust. This sort of sprawling growth of Louisville in the suburbs and exurbs and combined with conventional agriculture has really led to some unhealthy environmental quality metrics here in Louisville, right? You want to talk a little bit about that challenge and how land trusts fit into solving it?
Sure. So I think you really need to look at landscapes holistically and not just in a vacuum. So when I start to think about the mix of land use that we have here in Louisville, Jefferson County, there's some open space and farmland that we have as a community, we severely undervalue. And we tend to think of what's its economic value, but we never think about what the value is of what we lose. For instance, when I try to get people to think about flooding problems that we have, and they just see the water, but they don't see the landscape from whence it comes
from. Whence it comes, yes.
And so we don't really have a flooding problem. What we have is an infiltration problem. So
right.
for years, we had infiltration because we had farmland, we had open space, we had all these green spaces that absorbed water and held it in place. And the more we developed more concrete and asphalt and the more we compacted the land in the areas where we built at, we had faster runoff problems. Faster runoff, we picked up more chemicals and pesticides, and we hurt our water quality, we hurt our stream health, and we put places in danger of flooding that never happened before because we've changed the landscape. So wouldn't it make sense that some of the cheapest measures that you've got for flood control happens to be preserving green space with porosity?
Yeah.
It's cheap. So the thing that has to happen is you've got to find a way to encourage farmers that hold farmland to continue to farm. And it may be supporting them in terms of providing some tax incentives for them to stay in place. I remember when I came to Louisville about 40 years ago, and I was still working with the same agency, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, I remembered meeting with MSD and mentioning the idea of, wouldn't it be great if our community invested with farmers to build private ponds on their property for flood control. And the reason is because farmers were building ponds anyway to store water for their livestock.
Sure, yeah.
But instead of making the dam 3 feet, 5 feet higher than the permanent water elevation, they would only make it about 6 inches. Why not have the community invest in that other 3 or 5 feet and get additional flood storage? And it's a lot cheaper than building a lot of great big flood retention basins and adding on to the flood wall. So invest with that. Make part of those farms a bigger part of the flood infrastructure of this community. It never happened, but it was a good idea. But again, some farmers were thinking in that terms because they were building what's called additional freeboard onto those dams. They were making them higher just to store additional water because it was of an immediate benefit for them. But there's some things that we can do as a community to invest in the value of saving that open space, because once it's gone, it's not going to come back. And every time you pave over significant amount of areas, there's something that you're going to pay for downstream. Okay, we have issues with heat islands.
Yep.
We have issues with flooding. We have water quality issues. I think it would be great if every kid in Louisville, Jefferson County could go down to Beargrass Creek, stick their mm-hmm. hands in the water, pull out minnows or crawfish, and just enjoy the water. It's not good when you go down there and you see, after a storm event, these signs that say, don't play in the water.
Yeah.
Well, for kids, they're attracted to water. Even adults are. You see a lot of the buildings that are downtown, one of the things that they put in as an amenity is a fountain.
Yep.
Because right. people are drawn toward water. Well, we've got all this water here in Louisville, Jefferson County. We have Goose Creek, we have Pine Creek, we have Black Pine Creek, we have Mill Creek, we've got Floyd's Fork. We have water. It's up to us to take care of it. And it's public water. And just like me, when I was growing up, we had a creek on our property. I enjoyed just leaving the house, taking a cane pole, going down to the creek,
oh, yeah.
and fishing. And I think every kid should be able to do that in every creek that we've got here. I mean, it won't cost you anything to find an earthworm if you know where to look. Okay, so earthworm's pretty much free. If you can't buy a rod and reel, a cane pole works just fine. Very little investment.
Yep.
But it's enjoy the nature, get connected to water quality, get connected to those things that you're going to be making decisions on in years to come. I mean, a lot of people don't care about water quality because they never went to the place where water ran free.
Yeah.
And understood what its value was and how they were connected to it. The more you understand it, the better you will treat it.
It'll get in your blood.
Yeah, yep. It will actually do that.
Yep. That's right. Well, that's a great note to end on. I'm sorry we're out of time because I'd love to talk to you all day, but this has been wonderful. Thank you for taking the time today, Kurt Mason.
Okay, thanks, Justin.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. Coming up in just a minute here on Sustainability Now, your community action calendar. All kinds of ways you can get involved this week in making sustainability a reality now here in Louisville. So stay tuned, my friends.
When I was a child, I walked these hills, drank from the streams and heard the whippoorwills, and I ran through the fields just as fast as I could, through rocks in the creek, up in the deep green woods, climbed up on the mountain, there as fresh as could be. Let my Kentucky soul fly free, fly free. Down from the Ohio to the big Sandy, and up in the mountain holler, down to the big city. Gonna let my Kentucky soul fly free. Now that I'm a man, I live in the big city. It's a crazy life. Don't bother me. It's deep down inside, I'm still a country boy. You know I gotta get back to where I was born. Down by the rivers, where I long to be. To let my Kentucky soul fly free.
And we are back here on Forward Radio, WFMP LP Louisville 106.5 FM, your community radio station, broadcasting from the top of the historic Hayburn Building here in downtown Louisville at 4th and Broadway. My name is Justin Mogg. You're tuned in to Sustainability Now. Behind me now are the great folks at Appalachian. Many thanks to them for giving us permission to use their great local music on the podcast versions of our shows. You can find all of our local programming archived at forwardradio.org. Listen on demand, and you can learn more about Appalachian at appalachian.com. Well, now's the time on our program where we get out our calendars, get our pencils sharpened, and get ready to take action for sustainability. And it is a big week of social justice here in Louisville. Lots of ways to get engaged and involved. I mentioned this last week, but let me remind you that there is a 4-day crash course going on right now, Monday through Thursday, July 13th through the 16th, on Defund the Police. as part of the work to end systemic racism. You may have seen these calls to defund the police. For some of us, this demand is a new one and an unfamiliar one, one we may not yet fully understand how it would work or what it means for our communities. We are our best advocates when we are fully in grasp of what we're asking for, why we need it, and how we get it. And that's why we invite you to join for a four-day crash course on what it means to defund the police. Abolition is not about destruction, but about what we can build. When we think about safety, we must ask what our communities consider safe. Safe communities are not the ones with the most police. They are the ones with the most resources. Communities in which everyone has food, housing, education, income, art, and liberation. To believe in abolition means that we have a clear sense of the power dynamics at play. In this case, it means taking power and resources from the police and giving it to others. If you've been wanting to engage but aren't sure how to step in, this course is perfect for you. It is co-hosted by Mi Gente, Dream Defenders, Southerners on New Ground, the Sunrise Movement, Critical Resistance, and Afro-Socialists and Socialists of Color Caucus. It's a four-day crash course in which you'll understand what exactly the demand for defund the police means. You'll envision what a world without police could look like, and you'll get ready to take action to defund the police in your community. The training runs through July 16th every day, Monday through Thursday, with multiple time options available to choose from. You can find the link to register at facebook.com/conmigente, conmigente, facebook.com/conmigente, for the four-day crash course on defunding the police. Now, coming up Tuesday, July 14th at 11 a.m., just after this program airs on Tuesday, there'll be a webinar on focusing on sustainability using the Property Assessed Clean Energy, or PACE, finance tool. This PACE finance tool is used to implement energy-efficient improvements on private property. PACE provides access to affordable capital with no upfront costs to make energy efficiency improvements to residential and commercial properties. Extended-term financing allows for the property owner to pay back the loan over the time, as well as the potential to increase property values and reduce energy costs. PACE is a broad, flexible tool that can be applied to individual properties, as well as manufacturing campuses and business districts. The PACE financing model allows for property owners to access affordable capital to make energy efficiency upgrades to their properties by allowing the local municipality to place a special assessment on the property's tax bill. The debt is associated with the property, not the owner, and therefore is repaid by the property owner via the assessment on the tax bill, making the costly energy efficiency upgrades affordable in the long term. In Tuesday's webinar, we will be joined by the industry leader and look at how to use PACE in the context of green and sustainability goals and metrics. They'll answer some important questions, such as how will PACE fit into a community's effort to drive a more sustainable economy while pushing economic development goals and objectives? How can PACE be a driver of green practices and strategies to make a community more environmentally friendly? Join us for this conversation and ask your pressing questions on sustainability using PACE. It's hosted by the Council of Development Finance Agencies. So you can find more information and the link to register at cdfa.net under their events page. Again, a webinar on focusing on sustainability using the PACE finance tool is Tuesday the 14th at 11 a.m., and you can find the link to register at cdafa.net under events. Also on Tuesday, but at 5:30, Louisville Showing Up for Racial Justice invites you to their monthly meeting this month on the topic of Let's Talk Abolition. It's at 5:30 p.m. on the 14th. Each month's virtual meeting covers a different topic for learning and taking action, as we recognize that white silence allows business as usual by those in power and continues the targeting of Black, Brown, and Indigenous and poor people. This month,
Let's talk about abolition. Why has the Black Liberation Movement been calling for abolition for decades? What is Defund the Police all about? Maybe you can't do the full 4-day training, but you can join this Tuesday evening Zoom. Can you imagine no police, no jails, no prisons? This is not something that can happen overnight, but what is the journey to get there? We cannot undermine white supremacy without engaging more white folks for work for a world where we are all free. To learn more about getting involved in white anti-racist work, find the link to join the Zoom at facebook.com/SurgeLouisville. That's S-U-R-J Louisville. Coming up on Wednesday the 15th, 4 to 5 p.m., Actors Theater Direct, live on Facebook, presents White People on White Supremacy and Becoming Anti-Racist. Join this special conversation featuring many folks, Chris Crass, Tulare McRae, Alexander Newton Shaffleton, Josh Poe, Jessica Reese, Adrian Silbernagel, and it's moderated by Emily Tarkin. Now, for July, all voluntary donations, and they're not required to watch, but they are voluntary if you'd like to donate. All of the donations to Actors Theater Unscripted will be shared with Roots 101, African American Museum. This event will be held on Facebook Live, and following the live stream, the video will be available on both Facebook and YouTube. But if you want to ask any questions or make comments via the chat, join live on Facebook Wednesday the 15th, 4 to 5 p.m. It's a multi-channel, on-demand creative content to ensure world-class theater continues to thrive and to enrich lives. You can find it online at facebook.com/actorstheateroflouisville. And you should know that theater is spelled the English way, then ends in an R-E. So Actors, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, of Louisville. Also, Wednesday the 15th at 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., there'll be a vigil supporting a Latinx family that's being racially targeted right here in Jefferson County. It's hosted by Louisville Showing Up for Racial Justice. The gathering will be at 511 Woodlake Drive. Now, this is way out east by Floyd's Fork off of Shelbyville Road and English Station Road, and that is a meetup address, not their home address. But the Pineda family has been racially terrorized for over a year, while the Lake Forest Community Association has done nothing. Join us to sign a letter to the Community Association and to support the family, or you can write your own. We're doing this with the support of the family and their support network. And you can find more news reports about this incident and why it's worth showing up on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/SurgeLouisville, S-U-R-J Louisville, for more information about Wednesday night's vigil, 5:30 to 6:30 at 511 Wood Lake Drive out in eastern Jefferson County. Also, Wednesday the 15th, it's your last chance to catch this Climate Justice web series entitled Seeds, Stories, Strategies. It's 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday the 15th. It's a timely collaboration between Center for Cultural Power, the Center for Story-Based Strategy, Movement Generation, Movement Strategy Center, and Race Forward. These five national field-building organizations focused on activating narrative, culture, organizing, and movement strategy for social and racial justice are coming together at this time amidst the deepening planetary crisis of COVID-19 and climate change to offer up a capacity-building series for the environmental justice community and grassroots environmental organizations. This series is bringing together grassroots leaders, community organizers, and allies to nurture the seeds of an irresistible future that works for people and the planet. Participants will learn and share stories about narrative and cultural strategies rooted in community and offer tools and frameworks to support radical imagining, narrative building, and movement building to advance climate justice. For information and registration for Wednesday 6 to 8 p.m. the Climate Justice web series, go to shareable.net. That's S-H-A-R-E-A-B-L-E.net. Now, this Thursday at noon, the University of Louisville Garden Commons will be relaunching their summer work days at the new Garden Commons location. We had to relocate it with the construction of a new dorm on the site of the old Cultural Center. It is now at the southwest corner of Strickler Hall, just east of the Speed Art Museum. And it's U of L's Organic Garden Commons in its new location, across the walkway from the biology department's beautiful Corfidge native plant garden, which is a sight to see right now. You can join us to learn by doing how to grow hyper-local, super delicious vegetables, herbs, and fruit. Anyone can work in the garden anytime, but we'll gather every Thursday at noon through the remainder of the summer. So that's through August 13th and starting this Thursday the 16th to harvest, weed, water, and plant. No prior experience is necessary. Tools and gloves will be provided. Please bring drinking water and bags to harvest into and wear a mask, and we'll be practicing physical distancing to keep everyone safe. The Garden Commons is open to participation anytime from students, staff, faculty, and community members. Everyone who comes is welcome to share in the harvest. You can get more information at louisville.edu/sustainability. And I also want to let you know that Extinction Rebellion Kentucky has issued a request for citizens to tell the Appalachian Regional Commission to choose people over petro and not the so-called Appalachia's petrochemical renaissance. So this note from Extinction Rebellion: there's so much important activism going on right downtown these days, but we also need you to look upriver at the massive petrochemical buildout, which continues to seek traction, public money, and government regulatory support in spite of the dim financial case and terrible environmental health consequences if they are able to proceed according to the industry's plans. This whole proposed investment is on the ropes. The coming year or two will show whether the buildout takes off beyond Shell's Beaver County ethane cracker plant. If this behemoth fails, we will be keeping a hell of a lot of carbon, methane, and radioactive particles in the ground and toxic waste out of our air, water, and soil. There are three opportunities to learn more and get involved in the resistance. Number one, a group of concerned citizens have drafted a sign-on letter, an open letter to the Appalachian Regional Commission. You can check it out on facebook.com/xrebelky and consider signing as an individual or as a representative of your organizations. Number two, also, if you're free, join us July 21st to 23rd at 7 p.m. for the next pair of sessions in the Impacts of Plastics series. You can register at impactsofplastic.com to hear Justin Noble present on radioactivity danger from oil and gas drilling and to join a group discussion and community forum on the issue. And number three, we also have an opportunity to listen to the inside industry perspective at the Northeast Petrochemical Conference. In light of the pandemic, it's been moved online, and it's this Thursday and Friday, July 16th and 17th, and it's now free to attend. So eliminating this financial barrier to attend is a tremendous opportunity for us to get an insider's view of the petrochemical industry and thus better organize against it. All rebels are encouraged to go to the conference registration page at petchem.com/northeast and sign up for a free vendor pass. By virtually attending this conference, we can achieve two things. One, we can learn from the mouths of industry personnel about strategies they are using and challenges they are facing. Taking and sharing notes from sessions of this conference can provide us with valuable information to oppose the petrochemical build-out of the Ohio River Valley. And secondly, with insider access to the conference, we can join chat rooms and Q&A sessions to make our voices heard amongst industry insiders. And stay tuned to Forward Radio, because soon after the conference, I will be interviewing a bunch of folks who attend the conference right here on Sustainability Now. So don't miss that. All right, folks, that's all the time we have for today here on Sustainability Now. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're staying safe, staying 6 feet apart, and staying active out there for sustainability. Can't do it without you. And I will be back in your ears again in 1 week's time, my friends. Be well. You and me, our whole world sings in harmony.